Good afternoon, everyone. Call this meeting to order. Looks like we have almost all the chairs filled, so it must be time.
Hello?
Thank you. We have two people on video conference. Is that correct, Jane?
Dillingham and Bethel.
All right. And Jane, would you please call the roll?
Abramovich.
Okay.
Albertson.
Present.
Okay. Alexiev. Okay. Georgina is here for Vladimir. Bandopadhyay.
Yes.
Bret Hart. Is Brian Rasley here for Doni? Okay. And we have Julie Cassio online for Steve Brown.
Yes.
C. Oh, on the mics on the tables that are on this stick, if you push the button in front, it'll turn them on. Oh, okay. So Kathy Arndt is here. Chambers. Chen. Cook. I think Christine will be joining us a little bit later. Davis.
Here.
Hi, Mike. Fallon.
Hi.
I thought I heard Chris. Yeah, okay. Pochisato. See, George Bettisworth. Is anyone here for Agenda? Gustafson. Anyone here for Karen? Hardy, Cindy. Hardy, Sarah. Healy. Anyone here for Joanne? Keaton. Henry. Johnston.
Here.
Okay. Online. Jolie. Larden. Lawler. Marr. Anyone here for Wayne? Okay. I see Diane down in Bethel. Meyer.
Here.
Nadine.
Here.
Newberry.
Here.
Chung Sang. Okay. Radenbaugh.
Present.
Thanks. Reynolds.
Here.
Short. Oh, Karen's joined us. Anyone here for Margaret Short? Okay. Valentine. Weber. Webley.
Webley's on travel, so he's not.
Oh, okay. And Winfrey. Kathy Winfrey. Okay. Windsor. Yari. Zhang. Okay, and let's say acknowledge our ex officio folks. We have Debu. Debbie's here. Registrar, Libby? Libby's here. Do we have anyone from staff council? Okay. We have our staff council secretary hiding in the corner, helping out with video. Anyone from ASUAF? Okay. Danny Shepard, athletics? Okay. Dean Lair? We have our provost, Susan Henricks, and waiting on our chancellor. Do we have John Dean here?
No, he's on travel, too.
On travel. Okay, thank you. Oh, okay, Margaret's here. Thank you so much.
Oops. Yes, I am on. We will skip over the approval of minutes because those have not yet been posted. Those will be submitted for approval at our next meeting. So we move on to adoption of the agenda. Are there any additions or modifications to today's agenda? Seeing none, the agenda is adopted. Status of Chancellor's Office actions. The five motions that the Senate passed at our last meeting have all been approved, and there are no motions pending. Comments from myself, your president. I have two short comments. One is to note that you should have received an email entitled Highlights, Faculty Senate Highlights from the fall semester. This is an attempt to more widely communicate what the Faculty Senate has done that the rest of the body of the faculty need to know about. So these were not all the actions. These were ones of wide interest or you know, importance to all units. I don't remember at the moment which ones they were, but it would be things like changing the grading policy. There was also a list of topics that the Senate is working on so that faculty would know about this. It's intended to be something that faculty can skim quickly and look into topics if they want more information. So we'd appreciate hearing any comments on this, good or bad. It's a trial effort. And we'll do the same after the spring semester. And the other point is that we are organizing another ad hoc committee, this one on joint appointments. And the main committee will be to look at procedures, policies. Has someone just joined us?
This is Christine Cook from School of Education.
Right. Thank you, Christine. All right. So this new ad hoc committee on joint appointments will be charged with looking at the policies for faculty evaluation primarily, and then some other associated issues that have to do with joint appointments. The main reason for doing this committee is that the Faculty Senate committees are in the process of revising the Blue Book, which hasn't been revised since 2006. And one of the issues that's come up is that joint appointments are almost absent from that book, and there's no guidance or discussion of how the rules and the collective bargaining agreement and the policies of the university apply to evaluating faculty who have joint appointments. So this committee will be set up during the spring and it will continue during the fall. It will be similar to the way we've done the interdisciplinary issues committee. Are there any questions, comments? No? David.
And speaking of the interdisciplinary issues committee, that committee is up and running as of about 3 weeks ago, and they have elected a chair, Craig Gerlach, who will be leading the effort of that committee to identify barriers and hurdles that are present and in the way of interdisciplinary research, teaching, and service. In future meetings, they'll be ready to start taking public input, and at that point I'll make an announcement. But meanwhile, they're up and running and meeting with a lot of enthusiasm, so I'm really pleased to report that.
Are there any questions for David? Has someone just joined us online?
Yeah, this is Danny Shepherd.
Hello, Danny. Thank you. All right, Brian Rogers is out of town.
Actually, he's in town. He may be here a little late.
Oh, good. All right. So let's set that aside for now. Provost Hemricks, would you like to make some comments?
Yeah, I'll make a few. Unfortunately, I'll try to get Brian, if he comes, not to reiterate the things that I will say because some of them may overlap with interests that he has. First but not least, I'd like to introduce Dr. Alex Fitz, who is the new Vice Provost of the university, And she will be, of course, working on supervising the general studies units, which include the Academic Advising Center, IRSA Honors Program, the Testing Center, the Upward Bound Program, and the SSSP program, two TRIO programs, grant-funded programs that we supervise, as well as being our accreditation liaison officer and spearheading the ongoing accreditation process. And have I left out anything that you yeah, I think that will probably keep her very busy, so I hope you'll join me in welcoming her to that position. The second thing I want to talk a bit about is the meeting that occurred last week on the Strategic Directions Initiative in conjunction with the Board of Regents meeting. Or actually it was the week before last, but it anyway, it occurred. That meeting was intended to move the process toward completion. They have a stated goal, that is, the people responsible for this at statewide have a stated goal of having the SDI process wrapped up and the plan or whatever the outcome of that will be exactly titled presented to the Board of Regents in June. So there was a lively discussion. They gathered input on some draft documents, and I expect that they'll be distributing some more final documents for some input, or at least making them available for input over the next several weeks. One of the big issues in connection with SDI is how we assess our progress toward the goals that will be established under SDI, and that's probably the most intensive piece of work that needs to be conducted over the next several months, is to identify the measures that we'll be using henceforth to assess university performance and to present it to the Board of Regents and to the Alaska public at large. The focus will be on what's being termed outcome metrics. That is, a lot of the metrics that we have used heretofore have been more in the character of input metrics, where we have number of students, number of dollars received in grant funding, and so forth. The new focus will be on products, things like graduates or even graduates who have obtained employment after leaving the university. Products of research might be patents or might be publications that are useful to addressing problems that are important to Alaskans. The idea is to present the university's work in a way that makes it relevant and important to Alaskans and then allows them to better realize the value of the university to Alaska. So that will require, as I said, a lot of work over the rest of this semester. And then the actual implementation of SDI should be an important factor overlooking our work in the years to come. The other thing that I wanted to briefly summarize is the results of the Board of Regents meeting. It was a reasonably low-key meeting. There were no big surprises coming forward from that meeting. There were the degree programs up for deletion, the MS in General Science, the MAT in Physics, MAT in Math, which the board approved. Those, if you'll recall, are programs that have had very little enrollment or no enrollment for many years. The CRCD, CTC master plans were approved, a project that quite a few people have been looking forward to for a long time, the vapor barrier project for the fine arts complex was approved. There was considerable discussion of the SB 241 report. This is the report on teacher preparation by the university and its progress toward meeting the needs for teachers in Alaska. There remains considerable concern that many of the teachers hired in Alaska, many of the K-12 teachers hired in Alaska are not Alaska residents. They're hired from out of state. Such teachers often are not retained for very long because they're hired into rural school districts. They find the environment very challenging, quickly leave the goal that has been established by the legislature and by the Board of Regents is that our schools of education will prepare more teachers who are well prepared to teach in rural Alaska, committed to teaching in rural Alaska, and who will help to fill the needs. But progress toward that goal has been slow. So there was considerable discussion of that report. And last thing is that you will have all seen the memo sent around by email about the budget challenges that UAF is facing in FY14 and going forward. People have asked a variety of questions around that. There'll be many opportunities as I go around and visit the units to ask further questions, or you can feel free to email me. But one question is how can faculty have input toward what the university does to help itself be successful and continue to be a strong university despite the budget challenges that we face. I would say that in part that's up to the faculty to decide how they would like to have input, and that you as a faculty can perhaps have another ad hoc committee, although I hesitate to suggest that, or whatever other mechanism you as a group would like to have in framing your input forward to the administration. There will also be faculty representation, as always this year and in future years, on the Planning and Budget Committee, which is the established entity for evaluating budget requests and for making recommendation on budget matters forward to the administration. So with that, I'll stop and be happy to answer any questions.
Are there any questions for the provost? All right, seeing none, we will move on to old business. First item of old business is a call for nominations for Outstanding Senator of the Year Award and for the Selection Committee. As of this meeting, the nomination process is open. You see as attachment number one an explanation of the purpose, eligibility, and criteria, and procedures. And essentially, to be eligible for this award, the person must be a member of the Senate or of one of the permanent or standing committees this year. And the procedure is that you submit a paragraph stating the reason for the nomination, and a cover letter, brief list of the accomplishments and a cover letter stating why you're nominating this person. Those materials go to the selection committee, which is composed of four members from the Senate and one person nominated from the Provost Council. And that selection committee recommends one or more people for this award. If more than one are recommended, there's an election at the next meeting. All right. Any comments or questions on that? Yes. And you're welcome to contact either me or Jane Harvey if you do have questions as you go through the month. All right, next item of old business, call for nominations for Faculty Senate President-elect for next year. And there are details of this in the Constitution and bylaws if you want to see them. The procedure is that by March 20th, nominees should submit a statement of interest to the Faculty Senate office. That will be reviewed by the Administrative Committee and then put on the agenda for our next meeting. So we would like to have that by March 20th if possible. You can nominate yourself. That's usually how it works. If you wish to nominate someone else, please make sure that the person you're nominating agrees to serve as president-elect if elected.
And if you have any questions about this, or if someone wants more information on what's involved in this position, contact one of us or one of the past presidents, John Dean or Kathy Cahill or Paul Layer. We'd all be glad to talk about this, I'm sure. Yeah. Any questions right now? And the way this works, if there are multiple nominations, we will have an election at our next meeting. If there is one nomination, we will have a vote of affirmation. So there will be a vote one way or the other. All right, item C, motion to agree to the discontinuation of PhD in mathematics. There are two attachments for this motion. Attachment 2, which is the motion that was tabled in our December meeting, and it was tabled until this meeting, and that's why we're taking this up again. The second attachment is a statement from the program, the faculty who are trying to revitalize the PhD in mathematics. It lays out what they have done since the December meeting, what the current status of this effort is, and what they hope to accomplish by the end of the semester. Based on this memo from the faculty in mathematics, the administrative committee recommends that we again table the motion until the May meeting to allow time for this process to play out, because there's been concrete progress and we have an explanation of what the goals are for the next 2 months. Is there any discussion of this? If the Faculty Senate wishes to table this, I would need a motion to that effect.
I so move.
All right, and I assume two people moving counts as a second. So let's vote on the motion.
You can count mine as a second.
All right, thank you, Mike. Moved and seconded. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, say nay. Any abstentions? All right, unanimously, the Senate votes to table this motion until our May meeting. And thank you to the faculty of the Mathematics Department for providing the update. Item D, results of the faculty survey, I'm kind of sitting awkwardly. Results of the faculty survey on posting syllabi or an alternative course description. There's a long handout on this, both posted on the website and hard copies in the back of the room. I hope that you all have either picked up a hard copy or had a chance to look at the document online. There is a summary of the results in the first page of this. Essentially, there's widespread support for creating some kind of central course description repository or collection, if you will. And so we will move forward in some way. And so I'm using the responses from the survey to guide how we're moving forward on this. Here, let me pull up the exact numbers. So the numbers were, to question one, do you favor creating a central online repository of course information? Yes, 71%. No, 22%. No opinion, 6%. The other questions had to do with whether these materials would be publicly accessible or only accessible to those with a UA online login. And the UA access only carried by 55%. Public access was 37%, so a narrower margin on that one. And there were quite a few comments that people submitted that will be helpful in sorting that out. I would say that the answers to that question and the comments on other questions indicate that we would get much broader support from faculty and less resistance if it were a restricted site and not public. And considering this is a brand new effort, I'm going to recommend that's the direction that we head. The next questions had to do with individual faculty. Would you be willing to have your syllabi posted on a restricted access site or expanded courses descriptions of your courses on a restricted access site? The answer to the syllabi was yes 74% and no 26%. Expanded course descriptions, yes 83%, no 17%. And again, if I look at the comments that accompany the people who said no, it indicates that some adjustments we could make in the plan to make it more acceptable to faculty. And then the last question said, what should the central repository contain? And the margins of difference in the answers were much smaller. The most popular answer was either one, instructor's choice. That was 49%. But I also am interpreting this as a default answer because faculty would always like to have the choice. There were some comments that indicated or pointed to advantages and disadvantages of posting syllabi and posting expanded course descriptions. We will look at those as well, and not just at the numbers from the responses. So there's a lot of information in this handout. All of the comments are included, and the results are sorted by subgroups, location, unit, faculty rank. So take a look if you're interested in the details. And the next steps on this will be to answer two questions. One is, where would we create or host something like this? And as I understand it, there are three possibilities, either within Blackboard, within UA Online, or within CourseLeaf. And we'll be talking to OIT and some other folks about those possibilities. And the second big question right now is creating a template to show faculty what an expanded course description would look like and give you something concrete examples to show what would be involved in creating this. How much work would it be? Could the staff create this from your syllabi? Is there anything in there that you feel is sensitive and shouldn't be included? So the next step will be to show you all a template. There is a draft in existence, and I intend to bring this to the Senate for our next meeting. So right now, this is all still in the planning stages, and you will not be asked to vote on anything until we can show you the template for the expanded course descriptions. All right? Any comments or questions?
Quick question, please.
Yes.
In terms of the poll, I'm sorry, I don't have it here in front of me. Was it very representative of all the faculty? I mean, what was the percentage of faculty that answered it? And in other words, are we just getting a small segment of people who cared to answer it, or are we getting something across the board?
We got 180 responses. It's hard to say exactly what percentage that is because we invited the adjunct faculty as well as the tenure track research and term faculty. And we don't have an accurate count of how many adjunct faculty there are. So I could give you a percentage of the tenure track research and term faculty who answered, but although I don't know if I've calculated that. I did compare the distribution of faculty by rank and by unit, and those were pretty representative. But I was including the 40 adjuncts who responded to the survey. So as far as I can tell, it's representative of the faculty. I just can't say in a rigorous way that it is. All right? Does that answer your question?
Thank you, yes.
Any other questions? Yes, Brian.
So what's the so kind of nominally follow up on that? That there's less than 20% of the people probably responded. Is that, let's say 20% did. Is that normal for these kind of surveys?
Well, not being a social scientist, I think it is. Cecile, as a social scientist, do you want to answer that?
yes, for surveys without follow-up and larger efforts that is pretty normal. It doesn't mean that the sample is representative than you'd like. But in order to make it more representative and get up to the 40, you have to put a whole lot more effort into it.
The only thing I would add to that is that I I think it's probably fair to assume that the faculty who care most about this topic probably answered the survey, or at least were overrepresented in the results of the survey. And so, in fact, I would guess that we got more negative responses than we might have if we had answers from all of the faculty. I don't know if that's accurate, but that's what I personally think. Any other comments? Can you use the microphone, please? And hit the green, hit the button to turn it on.
Try that. I'm actually kind of wondering, whatever form they get published in, whatever it is that people eventually settle with, are there plans to basically strip out the identifying information, the actual name of the instructor? Within the Department of Math and Statistics, there's some concern that students will start shopping around and decide such and such an instructor has, oh, they have a policy that I especially like. It emphasizes the homework, and I know I do terrible on exams, so they'll take it from that instructor and basically do course shopping. But if there's no information that will tag it to the instructor or anything like that, I think there would be people would feel just generally better about it. Make it clear that it's an example rather than a template that they can point to and say, this is what will happen if I take it.
Yes, and that concern that you just articulated is one of the main reasons for not posting syllabi and instead posting this thing called an expanded course description. The template that we have right now does not include instructor names, does not include assignments, does not include a grading policy. It almost all elements in it are drawn directly out of the syllabus, but they're selected from the syllabus. So it's the course description, it's the course goals, the learning outcome, prerequisites, but not what are the assignments and not who is the instructor. So yes, I think that we are going the direction that you had hoped, I think. Anything else? Yes, David.
Margaret, to address part of your question is that already in the catalogs, instructors are identified with their classes. Are they not as part of the description if they're just the one person? No. And the schedule, that's right. It's in the schedule. That's true. Okay. But the main concern that I think that you have is for courses that have multiple instructors. Sometimes courses have only one instructor ever. Would you have an objection to those names being posted?
There's even a bit of an issue there. There are courses that I've been either the only instructor or been the instructor most of the time. And I end up changing what I do quite a bit from semester to semester. I've actually been having a really hard time finding an appropriate textbook for some of the classes. So which is, if you look for something like that, it's not going to be
Thank you, Margaret.
You write the book.
Anything else? Yes, Debu.
So I'm thinking that there will be more discussion on this before. And I just wanted to make sure of that.
Yes, definitely. Probably much more extensive discussion when you have something more concrete to respond to. All right. Let's move on. Chancellor Rogers has joined us. Chancellor, would you like to address the Senate?
Yeah, I would, and I appreciate the opportunity to do so. I spent most of last week in Juneau. Had the opportunity to visit with 26 legislators or their staff individually. It's not a really great year for us down there, coming on the heels of one last year that was extraordinarily good. As you'll recall, the governor had approved in his budget request 50% of our pay raise money and then some of our fixed costs to include the opening of new facilities. The House Finance Subcommittee acted to reduce the university budget by $2.4 million, which is about two-thirds of 1% of the total. The bad news is that the method by which they did it, they stripped out everything the governor had added in other than the pay raise money, and the effect of that is to delete all funding to open the life sciences building. And their intent was just an unallocated reduction, but the mechanics by which they did it in the process stripped that out, essentially taking out $2.8 million worth of items the governor put in and then giving us an unallocated increment of $400,000. Now, the structure of the budget for the first time in a long time is a single appropriation, which allows the president and Board of Regents to move money around. So it's hypothetically fixable when it gets to us. All the president has to do is to move money from the Anchorage campus to the Fairbanks campus and move money from the Juneau campus to the Fairbanks campus in order to allow us to open the facility. This is not good. So I met with key members of the full House Finance Committee, and we're working to try to correct it. Suggesting to the legislature that they leave the opening of new buildings approved by the voters, that they leave that in and then give us a $2.4 million unallocated reduction. And the vote's going to be close when that comes up. We'll see how that goes. It is something that we have to fix in the House, because if we fix it in the Senate and the House has taken $2.4 million out in one place, and the Senate has taken $2.4 million unallocated, then the conference committee has the option of saying, yes, we'll take both, and now we're suddenly with a $4.8 million reduction. So a dicey situation for us. When we have the opportunity for testimony based on advice from the statewide budget office and legislative liaison, we may ask people to come and talk about the issue of life sciences. If we think that's already fixed, we don't want to make a big deal of it because it could create other problems. But this is really a very unfortunate situation, largely, I think, because we have mostly new members in the subcommittee and did not have anyone from Fairbanks participating in that House Finance subcommittee. On the Senate side, they have not yet started work on the operating budget. I wouldn't be surprised to see them come in above the House. They're a little less intent on cutting spending. We were told we should feel good about the $2.4 million cut because it could have been $5 million. For some reason, that didn't make me feel all that much better. But that does create a real challenge for us, because if we look at the university budget, we're roughly 40% state, 30% federal, 20% student and fees, and 10% other. And all three of the first ones were challenged next year. State funding, very tight. Federal funding, we all know what's happening with sequester, and potentially as much as average 8% loss in federal funding. Some of that will take a while to hit, won't hit until FY15, and maybe there'll be solutions there. We're already seeing some slowdown in NSF awards and in other agency awards. And then tuition, we have the smallest increase in tuition in over a decade. So that is going to create some real challenges in the next fiscal year budget, and we'll be looking for savings wherever we can find them. If we get the 2.4 reduction from the state and the legislature or the president fix the allocation, we're likely to go ahead and open life sciences, but somewhere in the million to million two below what we thought we were getting from the governor will be a reduction to the UAF Fairbanks campus and the other campuses. So we'll have to find that money. So one question is, where's the easiest place to find reductions and without impacting programs? And I want to suggest one that I'd like your help on, and that is we lease off-campus space in Fairbanks to the tune of about $1.8 million a year. If there were underutilized or unused space on this campus that we could move people into, we wouldn't have to be spending that $1.8 million a year. And there's likely to be some underutilized space on the campus. If you can help us identify it, that helps us look at how to reallocate space and make a difference. And, you know, some laboratories get less use than others. Some spaces get less use than others. To the extent we can economize on space, it doesn't hurt a program. And if the alternative to paying, instead of paying rent, we can have offices on campus, which we're going to do in part with the opening of life sciences. We will be able to move a couple of offices from off campus onto the campus. To the extent we can do more of that, we reduce budgets, we reduce expenditures without hitting people or programs. It's not easy because it's not always in the right place, but to the extent we can, that's a plus. The other big savings is in energy conservation. We've made a $6 million investment in energy conservation programs, and a portion of those savings, the savings we'll have, will pay off the cost of that $6 million, but a portion is budget reductions. And so those are two areas I want to look first, is in space and energy conservation, again, because that's much better than affecting people and programs. On the capital budget side, not really much action in Juneau yet. We did have an opportunity to speak to the combined heat and power plant and how that interacts with the legislature's push for gas to Fairbanks. The short version is the plant as we have it planned would reduce our annual heat and light costs from about $10 million to $5.5 million. If we go with gas, it's $13 to $17 million, so an increase in costs. But there's a capital to operating trade-off. We'll expect to see more discussion of that in the upcoming months. And there is significant support for money to complete the engineering building, or at least to keep work going on it through the next fiscal year. We have enough money to carry us to about this time next year, and so the final 4 months of the fiscal year, I expect some work to try to find that money to allow us not to slip a year on that building. Most of my focus, and I think the administration's focus in the next month or so, is going to be on trying to make sure our budget's as strong as it can be and that we've identified where else we can find reductions that don't directly impact our instructional and research programs. We'll certainly appreciate any thoughts that members of the Senate may have, and look forward to a dialogue about the budget issues in the coming months. And with that, I can answer any questions that members of the Senate may have.
Elizabeth.
I'm just curious, comparing with other state universities, is it typical for the income from student tuition to be 20%?
No. Typically, income from student tuition is higher, and for a university like ours, income from federal smaller and income from state smaller. We're at the high end among state support for colleges and universities and at the low end for tuition support.
Anyone else? Any other topics you wish to raise? All right. Thank you, Chancellor Rogers. And we move on to new business. The next item is the motion to approve the library science unit criteria. This is attachment 189/4. And Karen Jensen, as the chair of unit criteria, would you explain the background of this motion?
Yeah, so there were only a few changes. This is just a regular revision. And the changes primarily were a brief statement in each section about the library science workload, which is a little bit different than many faculty on campus. And there was also added some information, some criteria for promotion to the rank of full professor, which had not been in there before. Pretty much everything else is the same or just wording changes. Are there any questions?
Questions or comments?
Seeing none, let's vote on the motion. All those in favor of approving these unit criteria,
aye.
Say aye.
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 All opposed?
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Oh, we've got ayes trickling in. That's great. Any opposed, say nay. Any abstentions? Motion carries unanimously. Moving on, number B, the motion to amend the Faculty Senate bylaws pertaining to membership of the Unit Criteria Committee, submitted by the Unit Criteria Committee. This is attachment 5. And again, Karen, would you explain this?
Yeah, so this was something that Jennifer had asked us to look at. Oops, I'm looking at the wrong thing. So basically what we did is we updated the list of units, which was out of date, and added representation for somebody with a research institute. So those are the major changes here.
And I see you've also added library into the list of units.
Yes.
Since that has just this year been split out of CLA for Faculty Senate representation. Are there any questions or comments on this change to the bylaws? No? No concerns? All right. Let's vote on it then. All those in favor, say aye.
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 All those right. I have to give them more time. All those opposed, say nay. Any abstentions? Motion carries unanimously. Thank you to Unit Criteria. Number C, motion to amend the grading policy for C-minus, parentheses 1.7, as a minimum acceptable grade for major and minor degree requirements and prerequisites, submitted by Curricular Affairs. This is attachment 6. Rainer, would you please speak to this?
There's lots of ways to look at this, one of which is that...
Rainer, can you push the button and turn it...
Push. I have to keep pushing on it?
No, it's good.
Okay, good. There's lots of ways of looking at this. I think one way is that I made a mistake several years ago and did not check the Board of Regents policies before we made this change in how we looked at grades, minimum grades required. Back in the old days before we had plus minus, a C grade was considered minimum. When we changed to plus minus, the question was, well, is a C minus good enough? And at the time, the Faculty Senate said, nah, it's not really good enough. But we didn't check to see what grade policies were by Board of Regents policies, and that's what the next attachment is that we change our policies to. But essentially, Board of Regents policy is that C minus is acceptable, period. And our present policy is in violation of that. The easiest way to get around that is to step into a time machine and hit a couple of key people over the head about 5 years ago. The second easiest way is to say, okay, fine, we've made a mistake. Let's change it so that, in fact, a C minus is now acceptable for courses in a major, minor, or prerequisite.
Any comments or discussion?
Hi, this is Linda from the Academic Advisory Council. Find that a C is not a 2.0, and so a C minus is equivalent to 1.7. And so in making this change, that means that 1.7 grade is acceptable for majors and for 4. But it's not the lowest minimum grade for degree requirements like BA or BS degree requirements or for electives.
Julie.
I just wanted to be clear that this would be, if we made this change, it would be going forward. It wouldn't be retrospective.
We had a lengthy discussion about that electronically over the last month since the last meeting. And frankly, the only logical way to do this is to say, like we do with any other catalog change, anything that's in the new catalog is applicable if you graduate under it. Does not affect the minimum 2.0 required, both overall and in one's major, to be in good standing.
Yeah, that is stated in the motion. Yes, please.
I have a question about on the...
Is your microphone on, please? You just pushed the button once there.
The 2.0 overall GPA, will we need to change that in the future? Because if there's a case a student passed all course in C-, how can we defend that he cannot, he or she doesn't satisfy the overall requirement, right?
It's conceivable that that could happen, but we'll have to burn that bridge when we get to it.
Well, my question regarding that is, I mean, can you graduate in bad standing?
No.
I would, with your permission, I would say that the probability of getting all the way to the graduation stage is quite small, because anyone with below a 2.0 is placed on academic probation, and anybody with a GPA below 2.0 for two successive semesters is subject to dismissal. So straight C minuses would not result in a student continuing on. You can imagine all sorts of highly improbable scenarios, but I think that really this isn't a very likely outcome.
The other impact to that scenario would be that prerequisite courses still require a C grade.
No, this, everything goes to C minus.
No, I think there are copies of the motion in the back. It talks about prerequisites as well. Anything else?
So I think I was there 5 years ago, and I thought this was a mistake when we did it, but I should have spoke up then. This is a pretty sweeping change, actually. I mean, every major, every minor, every prerequisite. I'm actually seeing a couple other places in the catalog where if you take the credit, no credit option, then it's awarded for a C grade 2.0 or higher. Does this, that's not explicitly listed, so I presume that would not change. I'm just a little worried that the C, even if it's the wrong threshold, at least it's a clear threshold that we've sort of stuck with for, you know, 75% of things. And maybe rather than dropping 75% back down, we should look at the 25%, the transfer credits, the et cetera, et cetera. I'm not totally convinced we're in violation of the BOR policy here either, because a C and a C minus are different grades. Of course, that's one of these contentious issues.
No, the Board of Regents policy clearly specifies that a C, including C plus and C minus, is acceptable for all courses.
Oh.
Sorry.
Yeah, that would have been a nice out. Yes, David.
I just want to ask Reiner, have we considered stopping at C and then going to D instead of having a C minus, D plus? I mean, that is a better solution, probably. Just stop at C, then the next grade is D and F. You know, and then above C, we have all plus minuses.
No. Have not considered doing bizarre things with grades.
That would make sense to me, too, not have a C minus. That would avoid the problem, I would think.
So what does the person get, a void? I'm sorry, we don't give C minuses. We just give nothings.
Well, in practical terms, some instructors may elect to just go ahead and give Cs instead of C minuses. Just to address that. And so in this case, now an instructor would not feel compelled to budge a grade up from a C minus to a C in order to avoid having that student in that class again next year.
Dave here merely
stating
not his policy, but statements which have been made to various faculty senators over the last couple of months.
And conversely, some might give a D so that the student has to take the class again and do better in it.
Ken.
I'm on the committee that had this rather long discussion. During the meeting today, I just thought of one more thing. it is legal and okay for certain departments to elevate. These are minimum requirements, right? And so if a department has passed degree requirements mandating a C, this is very common down at UAS, for instance, where it's done by department. But if we've gone through and created programs with a C, a straight C, is it viable for us to, in mass, bring everyone's down? In other words, if the process went through the Faculty Senate, individually passing programs with a C, can we override that now with a C minus? Or do we have to, according to our procedures, go and revise every program that has enacted the higher 3.0, you know, a C standard? Do you catch that, Rainer?
Yes, I have. To my knowledge, no one has made a uniform requirement deliberately at C equals 2.0 for a major and a minor. However, as you point out, there's no reason why in the future a department can't do that.
All right. Susan, did you have a comment?
A couple of comments. One is related to the discussion that just happened. Departments could set more rigorous standards for grades, should they choose. I haven't gone through the catalog and see if any have chosen already. Most catalog degree requirement descriptions read, meet all baccalaureate degree program requirements and default to the general description of baccalaureate degree requirements, which would be covered by this change. But if there are any programs that absolutely specifically specify C 2.0 within their own degree program requirements, it's my belief that those would hold at C, and that if they wanted to change to allow a C minus, they would have to do that separately. The second issue has just to do with another reason for accepting this recommended change by Curricular Affairs, and that is that the current system of what counts and what doesn't is extremely confusing. That's something I think that the Advising Center can attest to. A C-minus counts in some circumstances but not in others, and it's very difficult to keep track for students of when it is and when it isn't acceptable.
Yes, Cindy.
This is for, is this on?
Yeah,
okay. This has also been discussed by the SADA committee, and we actually took a vote on this instead of going by consensus, and our vote was 8-1 in favor. So we discussed some of these same issues and felt that this regularizes the grade level for students, and also as long as the students still have to do 2.0 for good standing and for the degree, that sort of, if they get a C minus in somewhere, they have to also get a C plus to stay in good standing. And so we accepted that.
Cecile.
Let's not forget a C minus did used to be acceptable.
Precisely.
It was part of being a C.
And, precisely.
You know, now we just call it something different, but it used to be acceptable.
All right, anything further on this issue?
This is Christine Cook. I'm sorry, I might have answered this, but I got caught up and came back in, so I missed a second. School of Education just wanted to make sure that if we have specific courses that in the catalog say you need to have a B in this particular course, you know, having a higher rigor than the C minus or whatever, that those still hold if they're in the catalog, correct?
Correct. And yes, we did discuss that, and it appears that any specific requirements by the program or the school would take priority over this general university-wide level.
Okay, thank you.
Yes, Elizabeth.
Yeah, so what would it take to change Board of Regents policy to make it a C instead of a C minus?
Act of God.
It would require the agreement of all three universities in the system. That's not happening, I don't believe. UAS in particular is still okay with Ds for almost anything. Just the different three different universities have different standards.
What are the consequences of not being in good standing with this policy with the Board of Regents?
Well, this has, of course, been the situation for several years. The sky has not crashed down upon us. What I would see is some potential vulnerability should a student actually realize this and decide to challenge it. It could be grounds for a legal decision. Could create some problems that way.
I would comment that the confusion factor is also a serious one. When does a C minus count and when does it not? Is a widespread confusion source of confusion here. Cecile.
And I think in some ways we're sort of barking up the wrong tree. I mean, besides the fact that a C minus did used to be acceptable, isn't it much more important how we grade students' achievement? I mean, if we really grade on a full grading scale, then it wouldn't be an issue. Just throwing that up. Well, if people, we're sort of talking as if there was some objective standard for what a C or C minus or whatever is, but there really isn't, right? And so it's still up to every individual faculty member to determine what a C is, what a C minus is, what a D is, what an A is. And so I think the real discussion is how we use the full grading scale and what is an acceptable level of performance as opposed to whether we accept a C or a C minus, which is really, let's face it, pretty minor.
So what you're saying is we should quit discussing, approve the thing, and move on to more substantive issues. Is that right?
All right, anything further, or are we ready to vote? All right, let's vote on the motion. All those in favor of this change in the grading policy, say aye.
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 Aye. Aye.
All those opposed, say nay.
Holy crap.
Any abstentions? Two abstentions in the room. Are there any online?
One here.
Okay, three abstentions. Motion carries. Moving on. The next item is a break, and we are almost on time. We will break for 10 minutes and resume at 2:15. All right, we are continuing with new business motion number D, the motion to revise the grade appeals policy to clarify the time period within which grade appeals will be reviewed. This is submitted by the Faculty Affairs Committee. It's attachment 7. And our Faculty Affairs Chair will comment on this, please.
Yeah, so I have to say, I was a little surprised by the vigorous debate that started about this topic, but that's good, There was also a good email exchange after the last Senate meeting about that topic, so there was a lot of good input. And I took it back to the committee. We discussed it again and took all of the input we got into account. And in the end, it seemed like there was really no perfect solution for the sort of in-between regular semester time periods. For example, every grade appeals committee requires a student to be there, to be represented on the committee. So if we wanted faculty to be available during winter break, which we can say, we're on contract, we should meet over winter break, it would probably be hard to get a student to serve on a grade appeals committee over winter break. And so after kind of considering all the pros and cons and that there really isn't a perfect time, we sort of went back to what we had suggested to begin with, that if there is a committee available during the summer or during winter break, certainly there's nothing that prohibits them from having a committee meeting, but that the student shouldn't expect to have a grade appeals meeting outside of the regular semesters. And then we cleaned up the language in terms of the number of days required for all the things, so it's consistent within the policy, and are bringing that back to you.
Any discussion of this motion? No comments? Are we ready to vote on it? All right. All those in favor, say aye.
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 Those opposed, say nay. Any abstentions? Motion carries unanimously. Next, item E. Motion to amend the Faculty Senate bylaws regarding special elections to fill a vacant senator position. This is also submitted by the Faculty Affairs Committee. Attachment 8.
Okay, so this was brought to us by a unit that has had difficulties getting enough candidates onto the ballot during the regular elections, and because sometimes faculty don't quite know yet what they're going to be doing, and so sometimes I said we would have enough for alternates if it was later, if we had an opportunity to elect people later. And so again, we sort of discussed this: what are the pros and cons? Turns out that there isn't really much said in the Senate Constitution about this. So what we're suggesting is that there can only be a special election if the regular senator has to resigns for whatever reason, and there is no alternate available to fill that senator's seat. If that's the case, then the unit can have a special election within 30 days of the senator resigning, so they can be represented. We also added, because this wasn't in the Constitution beforehand, that elections are held in the spring. Right now it doesn't say when Senate elections are to be held. So we just added that.
Why did you decide on the spring versus the fall when people sort of know what they're doing?
Well, for administrative reasons, I mean, the Senate has to elect its new members in the spring. Plus, in the spring, people are doing workload, so that's the time when people do discuss what they're going to be doing in the fall.
Is an alternate available?
Use the microphone, please.
So if an alternate is available to fill this vacant seat, is that department then allowed to nominate an alternate? Or they're going to be without?
No, alternate. That alternate is your safety net. So if you have, you know, so once you use that alternate, you don't have, you know, you've used up your get out of jail free card.
Any other questions?
In a similar direction, so this election would be for one person, right? So we come in with the premise that we have one short because we don't have an alternate. And then one additional person drops out, so we have nobody to refill that seat. And then we elect only that missing somebody for that missing seat, not an alternate in addition.
Exactly.
Okay.
Right. It's an election for a senator, not for an alternate.
Okay. I was just wondering if that's clear. It may be.
Yeah, because it uses the word senator. Anything else? All right, let's vote on this motion to amend the bylaws. All those in favor, say aye.
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 Those opposed, say nay. Any abstentions? The motion carries unanimously. And the last item of new business, number F, motion to change UAF catalog descriptions of letter grades
submitted by the Curricular Affairs Committee. This is attachment 9. And we'll ask Rainer to comment on this.
Hi. We've got the old words and the new words. The new words are dark, bold, and in caps. The fundamental distinctions here are taken out references to average, as in C is an average performance. And including the C plus and C minus, essentially the ones in bold are the Board of Regents requirements. They're arranged a little bit differently from the way that it is stated in the Board of Regents, but essentially that's what it is. And there's two notions here, one of which is to bring us into compliance with the Board of Regents, and secondly, basically, to get rid of the notion that I'm pretty sure nobody has actually gone for at least a couple of decades, that C is actually an average grade. End of story.
Cecile.
So, I mean, this is going to sound sort of facetious, I suppose, but just because we have grade inflation doesn't mean we shouldn't sort of at least pretend that a C is still an average grade.
I love it.
I mean, just because there's pressure to give better grades, I think to me that's not a good enough reason to change that definition. I kind of thought that in the Board of Regents definitions and what you presented, we're kind of losing some of the nuance of what these grades actually mean. I think, to me, it kind of sounds a little, I don't quite know the right word to use, but I think it loses some of its meaning, especially the higher grades, of what it really means to earn a B or an A. I like the original definitions much better.
I guess one comment I'd make about that is that why specify what the average is at all in the grades? Different professors have very different philosophies about what they'd like to do. One potential philosophy is that they might grade on a curve in which C is at the middle of it. But other professors have very different ideas about grading. And if everybody does a really good job, perhaps they'll give everybody B's and A's, and the average is actually an A minus. But who cares if the students did really well?
Certainly, there's nothing in the Board of Regents policy which forces us to say anything about what constitutes average. And I see no reason to pretend that what is that everyone builds their grades around a C average.
Brian?
Yeah, I don't have any problems with the deleting the word average, but I do agree that...
Is your microphone on?
I like the...
Is your microphone?
It is on. Yep. I like the old wording for the B, which said it requires an outstanding ability. And the new wording is like, well, it has a high level. You know, I feel like that's a lot more wishy-washy. It also kind of implies that it's a two-level deal, high or low, right? And, you know, I just think about blowback that I get from students, you know, that they, you know, I like being able to point to that thing for the B that says outstanding level of ability, you know, rather, you know, I really don't like a high level that seems less definite about what that means in kind of in keeping with the comment about, look, A's and B's are honor grades, right? It requires, you know, an extra effort, which I don't feel is kind of clearly defined in the how these things are defined, redefined, or whatever. You know.
Susan Henrik?
Well, this quickly goes back to an earlier point. Ian a few years ago actually determined what our grade distributions were across the university, and for upper classes, that is the upper division, the average grade is right around 3.0. For the lower division, it's about 2.7. So that's what average is these days. The other issue is just with outstanding, since you're using that in the definition of A, you can't necessarily use it twice and also define B as outstanding. So if you're going to put outstanding back into B, you would have to think of another word for A.
Extremely outstanding.
Or whatever.
I actually think that the new definitions are clearer, because in the old definition, if you look at the A grade, for instance, it says the satisfactory completion of more work than is regularly required, which doesn't really sound so outstanding to me if it's satisfactory completion. And for the B, it doesn't say outstanding ability. It does say outstanding ability above the average, which is a relative term to me and doesn't mean outstanding as such. So I also like the new ones more because of the way the F is formulated. Because the old one just says indicates failure, which sounded a little bit too generic to me.
Cindy. Oh, there you go.
Sada also talked about this twice. And the first time we went through and Reinhard asked us to look at it and see what would happen if we just deleted the word average, and it made some of the others out of the C, it made some of the other sentences rather awkward, and we just rejected this out of hand. Then when we came back and looked at it as adopting the Board of Regents language, I think our committee felt, I guess it was 6-1 this time, but anyway, we felt fairly strongly that that language was clearer. Each of the sentences seems to be parallel to the other so that you can see a clear progression from one to the other all the way across the board, and it eliminates the whole question of average. So we actually favored this motion as well.
Anyone else wish to comment? Linda, would you wish to comment?
Quibble on D, where it says, under the Board of Regents policy, this grade is acceptable for elective courses. And again, just keep in mind, it's also acceptable for degree requirement courses. I have mixed feelings about whether we want to specify that. It does say, it does not satisfy requirements for courses in the major, minor, or graduate program, so there is implied. But there always has been a lot of confusion with advisors on what the grade is for the humanities and social science requirements for the BA. The BS is not typically a problem because those are prereq courses typically anyway. But there could be a couple of situations for BS in psych or anth or social, which is not a prereq. And then D minus would actually cover the requirement for the degree requirement for the BS.
Yes. Yes, both for the 18 credits of social sciences humanities and for the additional science and math for a BS. Unless any of those courses are prereqs, then a D minus is a perfectly acceptable grade.
So do we want to add that where it says elective courses or degree courses?
You know, then you could make a whole list, right, of
And
the idea behind this was to not simply say, I don't know. I could see your point.
It's just nice to be specified somewhere. It's not specified. It's always inferred or implied, but it's not specified in the catalog.
What, anything not forbidden is required?
Something like that. So it's just a subject to bring up if you wanted to add that to the D. Acceptable for elective and degree requirement courses.
Thank you.
Anybody have any strong feeling about that? So adding two words, degree requirement, sorry.
if you're going to add that, for clarity to students, I think that you would want to add the words, you know, for degree requirements that are not required by the major or minor or something like that, because otherwise they'll confound the two.
Yeah, and are we talking about all degrees or particular degrees?
We're talking about requirements for a degree which are not part of the major and are not part of the core.
Right, but we're not simply talking about bachelor's degrees if you say degrees. I think we're getting into a can of worms trying to put this in there.
Yes, the degree requirements was BA, BS, AA.
BM, BEM.
BM, BFA.
Ken.
I think one alternative to clear this up would be simply eliminate any language to referring to electives. Because basically it implies when you speak about electives, it implies that it's only
right.
If you simply deleted the reference to electives, it would default into our statement that it's not acceptable for a certain number, but not making any statement with respect to what ones it is acceptable for.
That would do it for me.
Well, one alternative would be to change elective to some.
Is there, what is the motivation for specifying that it's acceptable for elective courses?
But which, just to say, oh yeah, it's acceptable for something. Hence possibly changing elective to some. Seriously. It's acceptable for some class courses.
Well,
it's not acceptable for this, and that.
That's a redundant statement because if a grade is given, clearly it is acceptable for something. So, to me,
what's a grade of F acceptable for?
If this grade does not, and specify what it does not mean.
All right, Provost Hendrick.
In the spirit of moving things along, here's a compromise suggestion. We get rid of any reference to what counts with the D in this particular wording, and then we resolve to create, with very careful review and consideration of all the ramifications, a paragraph underneath that would specify what Ds count for, and or a footnote or something, a separate little description of the instances in which Ds may be acceptable. Because I think if we try to draft anything about Ds specifically here, we're going to make a terrible mistake.
So change to this grade does not satisfy requirements.
Any objections to that change?
Just a question.
Yes, sir.
Why do we have to say that at all? We don't say anything for the B that it's satisfying for grad degrees. Why do we have to say what it's good for? This is just a definition of grades, right? So
we just want to clarify that a D is not acceptable under these circumstances.
Yeah, I think it's a matter of drawing students' attention to that point.
Exactly.
I think that was the motivation for it.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
But it's becoming...
The Board of Regents guidelines on grades. They have a deficit specifically in there that it does not meet the requirements for certain things.
So can the BOR reg say it is generally not accepted to satisfy requirements in certain majors and in graduate programs?
Right, we don't want to say that.
Which is very Weasley.
Okay, yes. This is one of the few places where there is a slight modification of the Board of Regents agreed. It seemed very Weasley.
Cecile, did you have a comment?
No, I was going to agree with Franz what he said about that this is really definition of grades as opposed to saying how grades count towards certain things, but just a definition, an operational definition of what these grades mean. So.
All right. Since there are no objections to this change, we will make the change in the motion and we will consider it with that change. Is there any further discussion, or should we vote on the motion?
Do you need to read what it says
now?
Go ahead. Oh, call the question.
I was ready for the question.
Yes. All right. All those in favor of this motion to change the descriptions of letter grades, say aye.
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 Those opposed, say nay. One nay. Any abstentions? One abstention. Any other abstentions? All right. One nay, one abstention. The motion carries. And we move on to discussion items. The first item is about an advisor for students filing grade appeals. This has come up in background discussions about specific grade appeals over the last year or two. And the suggestion has been made and is being floated both in the Provost Council, I believe, and also in among the Faculty Senate Committee Chairs, that it would be desirable for students to have advice when they submit a grade appeal or when they consider whether to submit one. And the question is, who should this advisor be? The suggestion is that it should be their academic advisor. And now there has been some discussion with the Advising Center about this. Alex, would you like to address that, please?
This came up, I think it was at Dean's Council. Dean Lehrer mentioned it, that there seemed to be a need for this and that perhaps the Academic Advising Center would be the best place for this person to be located. And so we have had some discussions about whether that would be something feasible for them to do. And I think we've agreed that, yes, it would be feasible at the undergraduate level, but probably not for graduate students. So the question goes back to you then, if that is the desired solution to this by the Senate.
And this is open for discussion here. So you all wish to discuss this suggestion?
I just had a question. Would it be someone at the Advising Center or would it be the student's academic advisor? Because that's not always somebody at the Advising Center.
Yeah, the suggestion in Faculty Senate was the student's academic advisor. But the topic had also independently moved over to the Advising Center. And so that's one good topic. How do you all feel about that?
Well, my concern would be, what if the academic advisor is the person that gave the grade?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Another thing that we discussed in thinking about it being located in the Advising Center is, one, if the advisor is the person who gave the grade that's in dispute, or even in a small department, a student might not feel comfortable going to their advisor if the grade was within that department.
Mm-hmm. Paul?
Yeah, I just echo what Alex said. There's also the situation where if the advisor is advising the student to formulate an appeal against basically another faculty member in that department, then you're putting that advisor in an awkward position, especially if they're a junior faculty member, helping a student prepare, becoming almost an advocate for that student against a colleague. And so I think having a more independent person giving that advice as in the Advising Center is probably a better way to go than simply throwing it back to the department. The chair is supposed to sort of mediate the process in the beginning, and if that fails, then we're moving to something that should be maybe more removed from the process. And so I think the Advising Center is probably a better way to go.
Just a minute, Linda. Let's finish the discussion. Any of the other senators wish to comment on this? Yes.
I just had a short question. Is that a regular thing that happens, grade appeals?
Somebody else probably knows the number better than I do, but there aren't a huge number of them.
Cecile.
I actually, as we were working on our motion, I did ask Don Foley, and he said it's it averages is about 5 to 10 per year.
And that's typical for the last 2 years that I've seen as well.
Are students currently required to go through an advisor, or can they file appeal on their own?
No, they do it. They can do it on their own. But part of the problem is that they often don't do a very good job in putting together the grade appeal. I recently sat on two committees, and the students really did not help themselves in how they presented their case. So
are you including a new requirement that they go to an advisor?
Well, that's what we're talking about.
Okay.
You know, how does a student?
As a requirement?
Well, no, we're talking about the issue, right? Like, mm-hmm. Who should be their advisor? How do they go about doing it? How do we ensure that they put something together which is legitimate, which will, because it's also a pain in the for the whole process. And if it's built around an appeal which has no merit whatsoever, it's kind of a waste of everybody's time. And part of the question is how do we arrange this sort of thing so that student really understands what the rationale is for making a grade change besides I didn't like the grade I had, and how we educate them to create the evidence that they need or generate the evidence that they need for an effective case to be made. Basically, what we've seen to my experience is that the students act alone, and that by and large, some documentation which is required just isn't there.
Yeah, in some cases, I think Paul would agree with this, in some cases the student asks for help or gets informal help from someone involved in the grade appeal process, but it's not a formal setup, and the student is not directed to someone here. Go talk to this person to help you construct a grade appeal or to help you determine whether you have the grounds for a grade appeal. And so if we set up a system like this, it would be a formal part of the grade appeal process. It would that would direct the student to the academic advising center or whatever we decided, saying, go to these people for assistance. And it would be listed in the steps that the student should take. Right now, that doesn't exist.
But I've been involved in one very recently, actually, in one of those committees. And there is an extra element, actually, after that, because the student, if it is not satisfied, actually can hire a lawyer, an external lawyer, and actually follow up on that case, actually. So building all those previous stages actually set some information on how this will eventually may grow. What I'm saying is that if this information is valid or non-valid or whatever, so to make the case, actually. So this information can be used for the student to actually follow up with an external lawyer.
Mm.
Are you speaking in favor or against it?
No, I mean, I'm saying that we need to be very careful about, if to identify if really there is a case or not to make. Because maybe if the student doesn't have really,
Well, are you saying that we need to be careful about giving any advice to the student because that advice might be?
It might be used, that advice, as a document to actually build up a case.
Against the university?
Yes.
Okay, I understand.
The other side of that is that one way a student might, one grounds for a case might be that the student was not given adequate direction or advice during the course of the appeals process, in which case it might make it more likely that an outside legal case could be brought saying, that this was very unclear procedure or something like that. If we give clear advice to students about, okay, here's somebody that you can go to as an advocate, and this person knows about the grade appeals process and can guide the student in assembling the materials and meeting deadlines and so forth, all of that I think will give greater confidence, number one, of the student in the process, and number two, in my view, less likely that a lawyer from outside would feel like they could take on the case.
Franz.
So I think it's a good thing to have solid documentation about what merits a grade appeal somewhere available on an accessible page where people know how to get to. I also like the idea of having the advising center taking the lead because, speaking for myself, I'm as an academic advisor, I certainly would not know exactly what to do, and I'm sure that the student is way better served and the university is better served if the experts take over fairly early in the game. So I'd be in favor of that idea.
How early in the game are we talking? Are we going to advise them to go to the advising center before they've spoken with their professor or before they've spoken with the chair of the department?
Point. Paul?
My experience in the process is that there is a pretty good process where you're supposed to talk to the instructor and you're supposed to talk to the chair, and then the appeal, and it says the appeal is you recognize it's the last stage of the process, and that's going to be a final decision. And at that point, it would be advised to go to the advising center at that time to put together the appeal. If it can't be worked out on an informal basis with the instructor, I would say that would be the go. And the idea would be that the advising center would not be a gatekeeper. If the student has the right to an appeal, and this is not a gatekeeping, but it is rather as an advisory role to help the student prepare that thing. And so the student could decline to go there and do it. It would be their right. They wouldn't necessarily need that advising center signature to move forward, but it would be something that we could have as a way to help the students.
Ouch.
In answer to John's question, part of the language in the appeal process is that the appeal itself is sort of after all other options have been exhausted. And so one of the things we talked about was that this person, part of the role of this person would be to actually explore with the student, have you exhausted the other options? Have you talked to the instructor? Have you?
Yep. Okay. All right.
So this was a discussion, and I have asked Alex to keep us up to date on any developments in this direction, and we can discuss any new proposals that come up. Okay? So let's move on. The next discussion item, next steps for learning management systems evaluation. There is an attachment for this, attachment 10, and David Valentine will handle this one.
So just a brief recap of what we're doing. Carol Gehring over at eLearning and I entered into a conversation last fall about various ways that we could evaluate potential replacements for Blackboard if and when we might want to actually consider that. We want to look at finding ways to get faculty input into that decision if one were to come along. And we decided on two ways that we would approach it. One is to have essentially a pilot program in which a number of instructors would offer courses using Blackboard and one of three other learning management system packages and offer that during the course and then feedback his or her experience at the end of the semester. The second idea was to take a focus group of faculty and essentially confine them to a small room with a computer and ask them to perform some tasks on the different learning management system packages and compare and report back on how those tasks went, what their preferences were, what their reactions were to the various LMSs. So Carol has, with her group over at eLearning, has set up the pilot that is now going on where we have several faculty comparing LMSs, learning management systems, throughout this semester. And while that's running, we've initiated the second discussion, that is the discussion over assembling some sort of a focus group to look at various tasks that faculty would do with the hope of trying to ensnare a variety of faculty. Carol has, what you see on the attachment, on attachment 10, is essentially the first suggestion that Carol made with respect to some of the tasks and criteria that might be used by the focus group in evaluating LMSs. Here are some typical things that faculty would need or want to do with these LMSs. And the reason why it's on the agenda for today is to essentially open the discussion for what you see that's not on here potentially as some things that would be key in your decision about which LMS you would prefer going forward. What do you see as crucial in your use of Blackboard currently or in the future use of some other LMS? So that's essentially the question for discussion today.
So does anyone wish to bring up a topic that's not listed in this list or to emphasize one that you feel is particularly important? Julie.
I would just I don't think I see it here. I would just suggest adding or removing students or to the classes, because we often have to do that at the beginning of the semester.
One that I suggested via email was keeping track of attendance. Currently, there's not a really straightforward way to do that on Blackboard. I kind of make it up as I go in my courses. If you don't have any feedback here, you're more than welcome to email me. I've been funneling some feedback, both from myself as well as the administrative committee, which came up with several ideas, back to Carol and her course designers to help in putting together the ultimate set of tasks for the focus group. The second part of this is now we're also going to be looking for people to who are willing to try out some LMSs in some sort of a controlled way. So if you are interested in that, please let me know, and then we'll be coming out and probably asking people. So thanks, Margaret. I'll write you down. And if anybody else is. Yes, and if you've already told me, please repeat it, because I'm over 50 now. So. No.
All right, with that, let's move on to public comments and questions. Is there a member of the public who would like to address the Senate? Alex, please.
I just wanted to mention, and you've probably seen some emails and announcements to this effect, but just to reiterate, the National NACADA, which is, I guess, used to be the National Academic Advising Association and now has sort of a different title. Regional conference is in Anchorage, the end of April, the beginning of May. I have $750 per person funding available for up to 25 people. There are flyers back on the table that give instructions about how to apply, but basically you can just go to the provost website, to the general studies website. There's an application on there. They're just like three questions. The deadline is this Friday at 5 o'clock. I'm really trying to encourage faculty to apply, and I will prioritize faculty as I give the funding. Linda's probably a better person than I am to answer questions about the conference itself, but if you have any questions at all about the funding or the registration, things like that, feel free to contact me.
All right. Are there any questions at this point? All right. Thank you, Alex. Is anyone else from the public wish to address the Senate? Seeing none. Governance reports. Is Joella Sparks here from staff council? No. Anyone from ASUAF? And Debu Misra from UNAC, please.
Thank you. I have quite a few things to bring up. Is because
recording started.
We know that Faculty Senate is mainly deals with curricular issues and other stuff. But at the same time, the more feedback that we get as you know, representatives or whatever we call ourselves of the faculty, the better, because healthcare is not going to be an easy task to handle. So the more people give us feedback, the better. And we are all, vested in that.
Are there any questions for Debu or for Jane Weber, who's on the JHCC?
Well, some of us were out offline there for a while, so I'm not sure what all was discussed. But we at 3 o'clock we were cut off, so I'm not sure what was presented during that time. So, just an FYI.
Yeah, Mike, very sorry about that. Apparently, the connection was set to go off at 3 o'clock. Essentially, Debu described the handouts that have been provided by UNAC and talked about the content of them. So perhaps you could check those handouts and let him know if you have any questions. I'm afraid we also do not have a recording of that meeting because the recording also stopped.
Mike, you know about this. You were at the RA meeting. This was Bhatta's proposal on the healthcare issue. So I can send you more information on this later.
Okay. No, thank you.
All right. Let's move on.
There was a number of other.
Sorry?
I was just saying we weren't the only site that was cut off, so maybe some of the other members might want some of that information if it isn't already provided.
Yeah, anyone who was online or on video, please let us know if you want some of that information from Debu Misra. From UAFT, Jane, do you have any comments? No. Danny, are you still on the line?
I am.
Would you like to make any comments about athletics?
I would. I do have a lot because they've accumulated over the last couple of meetings, but I will be brief. The one thing I did want to make aware is the fall grade point average results have come in and been accumulated or been looked at, and just wanted to let everyone know there's just some really, really exciting things going on among the student athletes. The biggest highlight was that in the fall semester, the entire women's cross country team, that's 10 skiers, all 10 of them made the chancellor's list, which was a 3.9 or 4.0. So their team GPA was a 3.9 for the fall semester. So that was very, very exciting. So lots of other wonderful things happening, but I did want to at least get that out to let people know there's some good things happening. We have 5 teams going into postseason. 3 of them are headed into nationals, and 2 of them are undecided yet. So lots of wonderful, exciting things. Thank you.
That's excellent. Thank you, Danny. Sorry we didn't have so much time for you. Then we move on to members' comments and questions. Are there any comments in general or from the committee chairs? Anyone need to bring something? Yes, Cindy, go ahead.
Okay, technology. I just wanted to mention, since last time David announced that I was sitting on the GIRC committee in his place, and just a quick summary. They've divided into subcommittees to talk about different elements of the LEAP group. They've come up with some criteria for if we were to divide into, they're not sure if they want to call it designators or what they want to call it right now. And the GIRC committee is at the point of putting a presentation together for the next CAC, Curricular Affairs meeting. Reiner, I don't know if you know this yet, but we're coming. So, that will happen after spring break. So things are moving along, and after that, it should be coming to faculty departments and then for input. That's where we are.
All right, so you're expecting faculty departments by the end of the spring semester?
I think since I'm sort of ex officio on the committee, I would say the committee is expecting that, but we'll just see what happens after it goes to CAC and what kind of input we have to give it there.
Any questions for Cindy? Thank you, Cindy. Good to know. Anyone else want to comment on your committees or any other topic?
I just have a quick comment, and that has to do with what Brian said earlier regarding the budget and the involvement of the Faculty Senate in the budget process. We know that the budget is, you know, compromised or whatever you want to call it this year, but it's only going to get that's the pattern it's going to be for the future. So at some point, maybe at the next meeting or something, we can talk about how the Faculty Senate's going to kind of collectively be involved in that whole budget process and how the budget is put together, because I think it's going to be a challenging time for us as representing our various constituencies. So I'm interested in having that conversation more at length at another time. Do you understand what I'm talking about?
Yes.
Okay, thanks.
Anyone else? Seeing none, we are adjourned.
Let's see what we can do. Okay. Oh, God.